And so today we continue with our series on the Sermon of the Mount, Jesus' teachings from Matthew that represent the very essence of his message and his ministry. Just as the law was given to Moses on Mount Sinai, and that was considered to be the heart of Judaism, the Sermon of the Mount on the Mount is considered to be the heart of Christianity. Remember, the law handed down to Moses was accompanied by thunder, lightning, and fire. The new law was quietly and lovingly articulated by Jesus to his small band of disciples at the top of a grassy summit overlooking the Sea of Galilee. And as we said a couple of weeks ago, those chosen few that Jesus chose to follow him were not the learned priests and high temple authorities. They were instead unschooled fishermen and laborers, considered to be social and spiritual outcasts by the religious authorities. So remember, it was to these men, little review for those of you who weren't with us, it was to these men that Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. You are spiritual beings of infinite worth, here to let your light shine." And further, Jesus explains, "I have not come to destroy the law of Moses, but to fulfill it. I have come to bring you a new dimension of spiritual understanding." And that's where we're going to pick the Sermon of the Mount up today. Our primary source for today's lesson is the wonderful book, The Secret According to Jesus, by Unity minister and Bible scholar, one of my favorites, Reverend Ed Townley. Next, Jesus says, and this is in Matthew 5:19, "Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven, and whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom." Now, that's an interesting line, because we know that kingdom of heaven is where? Within. It is within us. And it's a little bit puzzling also, because in this context, we need to remember that Matthew writes really for one particular audience, and that is his fellow Jews. He is trying to convince all of them that Jesus is truly the Messiah prophesied in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. Therefore, as Ed Townley points out, it isn't surprising that Matthew is concerned with the relationship between Jesus Christ and Moses, the dominant figure of the Hebrew Scriptures. Matthew wants to reassure the Jewish people that embracing Jesus as that long-awaited Messiah does not mean that they have to reject the laws of Moses. Now, on the surface, I hate to say it, but this teaching of Jesus seems to fall under the umbrella of "Do as I say, not as I do." You have to look closely at that sign, okay? Throughout his ministry, Jesus will break countless Hebrew laws. I mean, just think about it. He will touch lepers, heal the sick, and encourage the disciples to pick grain on the Sabbath, talk to women and embrace Samaritans, prostitutes, and Roman soldiers. He will dine with those called sinners, fail to engage in ritual washing, and overturn the money changers in the temple, protesting temple sacrifices and absolutely challenging the high priest, just to name a few examples. Jesus must be referring to a different kind of law. And in The Revealing Word, Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore notes that the metaphysical meaning of the word commandment is having to do with the law of the orderly working of divine principles. The law laid down by Moses, as we all know, was one of outer behaviors. It was all the shall nots, right? Thou shalt not have gods before me, make graven images, take the name of the Lord in vain, murder, commit adultery, steal, bear false witness, or covet. While the laws that Jesus gives are of affirmation and love. Jesus comes not to nullify the law, but to just bring us to a higher consciousness about it. To Jesus, keeping the commandments means to command, control, and direct every thought according to the harmonious law of love one another. Very different from Moses' laws. So in all three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we read of the Pharisees gathered to challenge Jesus. And we've talked about this story before. One of them, an expert in the law, approaches Jesus with this question: "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" Now remember, in addition to the 10 given to Moses, on Mount Sinai, Jewish law required the believers to follow 613 additional commandments every single day. Don't rush out of the sanctuary today because I have your list for you, okay? How would we like that? We wouldn't like it very much. So surely the lawyer thought that this would be a question to really trip Jesus up and make him falter. I mean, how was Jesus to pick just one? But Jesus responds without skipping a beat. He says immediately, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets," meaning all the laws of the Hebrew Bible, "hang on these two commandments." In Luke, he says, "There is no other commandment greater than these." And we already said that kingdom about which Jesus speaks, we know it's not some future place. We know it's within. It's that eternal place of pure being where we know our oneness with God. And whoever lives from that Christ within and shares the process with others will rise to the highest level of oneness and will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So that's what that one means, I think. Ed Townley reminds us that we achieve that kingdom when we choose to live in the consciousness of the indwelling presence and power, when we choose to allow Spirit to flow into every cell, every thought, every life experience. And this is the covenant that actually was predicted in the Hebrew Bible several places, but especially in Jeremiah, where we read, "I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people." And to drive home the point, Jesus' very next words are these: "For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Now we know that the scribes and Pharisees were highly respected people in Jesus' day. They were among the 1% who were literate. And we think of the scribes as simply copying the law, don't we? But actually they did that, but they also served as lawyers and judges. They interpreted the law, so they had a lot of power. And the Pharisees were those Jews whose spiritual beliefs purposely separated the Jewish faith from all the other religions in the world. They strictly obeyed all the written and oral laws that spelled out in detail which behaviors were acceptable and which were unacceptable to God. And notice, it was all about behaviors. Now, for those humbly dressed, uneducated men whom Jesus had chosen as disciples, this must have been a shocking statement. Ed Townley writes, "How could the followers of Jesus be more righteous than the very people, the scribes and Pharisees, who decided what was righteous in the first place? How is that possible?" Well, again, being righteous must mean something different to Jesus than it did to the religious authorities of the time. Something different from knowing and religiously following the law. More must be required to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now remember, righteousness meant, anybody remember? Right thinking. That's exactly right. Very good. Righteousness meant right thinking. Townley writes, "In this commandment, Jesus follows us to a new dimension, the right consciousness of a pure, clear awareness of our oneness. Righteousness is not about blind obedience to the law. It's about seeing our relationship with God clearly and rightly. Now, we may not know the law as well as all the scribes and Pharisees did, but we can be more completely awakened and attuned to the presence and power within than their law-focused consciousness ever could be. Remember, Moses himself never entered the promised land, and Moses represents the law. So, through surrendering to this was in the Daily Word, the surrender piece. Through surrendering to the total, unconditional love of God, we then enter the kingdom of heaven. And in the Revealing Word, Charles Fillmore writes, Pharisees represent thoughts that bind us to exclusive external rituals without understanding their meaning. At the time of Jesus, a Pharisee was one who observed the letter of the religious law, but not its spirit. They lacked the understanding of the spirit behind the law. The religiously educated Pharisees thought also that they were the only ones to do the work of the Lord. Everyone else was unworthy. Now, we love to beat up on the Pharisees and Sadducees and scribes, don't we? It's a lot of fun, right? But Emmett Fox says in the Sermon on the Mount, they were, for the most part, worthy men following the only law they knew. And their flaws were really the fatal weaknesses of the religious formalists everywhere. And they are spiritual pride and self-righteousness. Those were their flaws and their faults. Now, you know, we look at every character in the Bible and we ask ourselves, how are we like that character? And we love to be like Jesus and like King David at times and like, you know, Moses in some respects. But we have to also ask ourselves, how are we like the Pharisees? What can we learn from them? So if, like the Pharisees, we think we have all the answers, we judge ourselves as superior and look down on those whom we believe are not quite as spiritually evolved as we are, right? That's the problem. And when we are so full of that spiritual pride and self-righteousness, we become complacent. We're not open and receptive to further growth. Spiritual growth is one of First Unity's core values, and I personally believe that we are meant to continue in that growth with every breath we have for as long as we are on this earth. And remember in the Beatitudes, we talked about Jesus telling the disciples, blessed are those who mourn, and mourn means to be mindful, yearn, be passionate, be eager. So Jesus is saying, blessed are they who are passionate and eager to express God in greater and greater ways every moment of their lives. This is the kind of right thinking that fulfills the spirit of the law. So with this established, Jesus moves on. He begins to address what is really the true fulfillment of the law, the meat, the heart of the new dimension. In his famous, you have heard it said, but I say teachings. And there are several of them. We're going to look at the first one today. And the first one is from Matthew 21:22. You have heard it said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, is answerable to the court, and anyone who says, you fool, will be in the danger of the fire of hell. Wow. So, when the people were told at the time of Moses, thou shalt not kill, obviously that referred to the act of killing another human being. But Jesus is taking the old commitment to a new dimension. It is not enough to refrain from murdering someone. Actually, that's a pretty low bar, is it not? You know? So it is not enough to refrain from murdering someone. It's about what we hold in consciousness. It's not about behavior. It's about being. God is love, and we are on this earth to be that love in expression. When we hold anger in our hearts, when we hurl insults to others, belittle them, fail to behold the Christ in them, then we are subject to judgment. Now, interesting, the word raka is an expression, or was an expression, I should say, of indignation and absolute contempt. Some say it is derived from a word meaning to spit upon, which in the Hebrew culture and at the time was the greatest possible insult from one human being to another. Now, is this not the exact opposite of love your neighbor as yourself? It seems like it is. The Interpreter's Bible says, notice the Godwardness of the new law. It emphasizes that we are all brothers and sisters because we first are all children of the same God. And we know that anger can destroy trust, confidence, friendship, goodwill, and other qualities that give life spiritual value. Charles Fillmore writes in The Revealing Word, whoever in anger hurled the word raca or fool at another was a killer, a destroyer of life's best gifts. Now, interestingly, the Greek participle for being angry here is in the present tense. So that really suggests being in a continued state of anger, not just getting angry one moment, but, you know, being there in a continued state. Now, let's think about Jesus overturning the money changers. People disagree about this, but it seems to me that it was a flash of anger. It surely looked like anger, did it not? But the thing about Jesus is he did not build a condo and live there, right? Right afterwards, almost immediately afterwards, he says, you have made my house a den of thieves when it should be a house of prayer. He lifts it to a higher consciousness. And we all know that life is consciousness, and thoughts consistently held in mind, especially with strong feeling, reproduce their own kind. Where? Those of you who are with me yesterday or with Ann and me, in our consciousness, right? That's where that happens. And we reap what we sow. If our consciousness is full of anger, hatred, and resentment, that becomes our focus, and we reap the negative energy of that anger. And remember, we've said before, energy flows where our attention goes. And that actually means we can reap negative consequences of our anger even if we never act upon it or verbalize it, as long as it's in our consciousness. Ed Townley writes, as we become aware of the creative power of God expressing through us, we begin to see that just controlling our behavior is not enough. Changing our behavior is important, but if we change our behavior and still hold hate in our hearts, we are still mired in negative energy. A saint was asked, what's anger? And he replied, it's a punishment we give ourselves for somebody else's mistake. In other words, the thing is, we just simply cannot give our inner peace and power away. Inner peace begins when we choose not to allow another person or event to control or hijack our emotions. Is it easy? No. But it's a practice in which we must engage. And what in the world does Jesus mean when he says, you shall be liable to judgment? It doesn't sound like Jesus, does it? Charles Fillmore tells us that judgment is a faculty of mind that can be used in two ways, from sense perception or from spiritual understanding. And if the action is based on sense perception, its conclusions are fallible and often condemnatory. If based on spiritual understanding, they are uplifting to self and everyone around us. And the term Judgment Day represents a sense of separation between the true and the false. The hell of fire to which Jesus refers is simply a place where purification is taking place. It's a metaphor. In the New Testament, the Greek word for hell was Gehenna. It was the fire pit in Jerusalem, a place where things of no practical use ended up to be burned and released. And that's where it looks like, what we think it looked like in Jesus' day, and I took that picture in Jerusalem of what it looks like today. And so in these teachings, and in all the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, that we will explore in the weeks ahead, Jesus is telling his disciples and us that mere obedience to traditional religious dictates is simply not enough. There is a difference between religion and spirituality. It has been said that religion is humanity's way of expressing our relation with a higher power corporately together. Spirituality is that relationship. It is that oneness. And as spiritual beings, it is absolutely vital for us to recognize, claim, and live from our innate spiritual identity. The healing, energizing power of God must be the source of how we treat one another. Ed Townley writes, and we're going to give him the final word today. Ed Townley writes, if we allow that energy to flow freely, not as an obligation, not as a rule or a ritual we have to follow, but as a joyful expression of our divine nature, we will achieve a new dimension of compassion, and we will transform this fear-based world into a love-centered kingdom of heaven. And so it is. So let's take a moment now just to turn within and affirm the great truth about our God. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this is printed in your bulletin. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and in our lives, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and in our lives, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.